moons orbit the giant planets much faster than our moon orbits Earth because the giant planets are more massive. One of Saturn's moons, Prometheus, which is similar in size to Earth's moon, produces eclipses lasting less than 1 second as it whips around the sun. Most of our eclipses last anywhere from just under 7 minutes to just over 7.5 minutes. So we have long solar eclipses in comparison to other planets. Of all the planets and moons in our solar system, Earth's moon affords the best vantage point for viewing solar eclipses. Now, why is this a big deal? Well, let me tell you why this is a big deal. Why are solar eclipses so important? Because they help us learn about the nature of stars. They help us learn about stars. When that moon covers up that sun, it shoots off those various colors on the outside. It helps us learn things about stars. And that's enabled us to understand things about stars that are farther away. A second reason why solar eclipses are so important is because in 1919, a perfect solar eclipse allowed some scientists to prove Einstein's theory of relativity. And that was only possible to prove during a solar eclipse. Third, perfect solar eclipses provide a historical record that has enabled astronomers to calculate the change in Earth rotations over the past several thousand years. This is a big point. Rick was talking about calendrical issues earlier today, and our ability to know when exactly solar eclipses occurred has helped us calculate when things took place in the ancient world, which has in turn helped our understanding of the Bible as well. Here's the point that I'm driving toward. What I'm hoping you can see is that the relationship between our sun, our moon, and this planet... Wow, I'm really far behind here. I'm sorry about that, guys. This correlation between, or this relationship between our sun, our moon, and our planet that makes it habitable also makes it fit for scientific discovery and measurement. The humanist concludes that all these factors are mere chance, that the randomness of the universe makes us the beneficiaries of evolutionary roulette. Does it not seem reasonably, if not statistically unlikely, that a world uniquely suited for hosting complex life, as well as scientific measurement and discovery, would just happen to evolve a conscious species equipped with the mental faculties of such observation? Instead, could we not attribute this correlation between habitability and scientific discovery and measurement as evidence of design? That the very time and place where perfect solar eclipses occur and appear in our universe also corresponds to the one time and place where there are observers to see them. This is the main point. The evolutionist, the humanist, looks at our solar system. They look at our galaxy and our universe, and they see us as the beneficiaries of pure luck and chance. And yet here we are, a conscious being on a habitable planet, with all of the opportunities to observe the world around us and the universe around us. All these factors playing in together, is this really mere chance? I don't believe so. Far more satisfactory than pure chance is the conclusion that our world was designed for conscious beings' observation, that our consciousness is no arbitrary development in the blind evolutionary process, but was implanted purposefully to observe the created realm and conclude a creator exists. I'll close with this quotation here on this particular part of my presentation. Is it not a curious coincidence that everywhere postmodern science and postmodern philosophy posit no cause, no explanation, no foundation, no ground, no reason is precisely where the religious mind finds God. It is almost as if Western thought has been playing an elaborate intellectual game with a single overarching rule. The ultimate reality to which all evidence points must be denied. I hope that was helpful. I'll open it up for any questions or comments. I understand you start talking about science, you get that glazed look in your eye. And I kind of feel the same way myself, but I do think that there are some benefits to looking at these things. And it's interesting. Lewis, is that a hand? Go ahead. That's a good way of putting it. We've made things exceedingly complicated, but we're also avoiding the easiest answers. And we're not following the evidence to where it leads. That's one of the real downfalls of modern science, is we're not really following the evidence where it leads. We're following our assumptions, which is creating a lot of bad science. Anything else? Yes, Rex, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Makes me think of that one line in the song we sing, the music of the spheres, the harmonious symphony of the created realm. Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Everything is working together. And there's so much more evidence. I mean, I just touched on one small, it may seem like a very large point, but it's a very small point, and all the different factors that go into this planet even being habitable, and the fact that we're here, it's just really amazing. I mean, if gravity was changed 1 degree one way or the other, this universe would just collapse. This is a finely tuned machine that we live in, and it just didn't happen by accident. They want us to believe that this universe is just one of billions of possible universes that have happened. I mean, Stephen Hawking is coming up with this idea now that we're just the offspring of another universe. It's just bizarre. The types of ideas that man will reach for that lack the evidence that he says that the evidence of God lacks. It's really amazing what man will accept and what he will deny. All right, I'm going to get off my soapbox here. Anything else before we conclude? We're going to go over to morality here. We're not going to get to reason tonight, but I'm sorry, I probably took more time with that last one. Go ahead, Tom.
Jesus said that the first of the Sadducees' error was they didn't know the scriptures or the power of God, and that's still the source of error today. The source of this error is that they don't know the power of God.
Yeah.
And the evidence is all around for the power of God, and they can't destroy it.
Yeah. Very much. Very much so. Anything else? Okay. Yes, Charles? Yeah, and you know what's really interesting, Charles, that you bring that up? Those quotations all came from a book called The Humanist Anthology. This is a book that they publish, and they put out saying, hey, this has been around for centuries. It's probably more manifest now than it has been in time past. But yeah, you'd think it would have changed, but it really hasn't changed at all, has it? Hasn't evolved. All right. Humanist morality. And this is going to touch on some of the things that I'm sure Kenny's going to talk about, I think, tomorrow. Humanist morality is summed up with the statement that they believe in God with a double O. They believe in good. A humanist believes that morality is a human construct that is underpinned by our biological development. In other words, our morality comes from evolution. And since our morality comes from evolution and not from any outside source, a humanist believes that morality is subjective, not objective. Now, does everybody understand the distinction between those two words? Objective means outside of our experience, outside of our own understanding. The Bible is a piece of objective truth. My opinions, however, are subjective because they're in my mind. They're based on my experiences, so on and so forth. Since our morality is a part of our evolution, according to the humanists, it is subjective rather than objective. And I put a quotation up here that I think really betrays the heart of humanism, and it does so, I think, at the author's own admittance. Humanism is in many ways a response to one book, one very old book that purports to have a moral message, and this purported message has in truth reached and influenced millions. And the message is wrong and frankly pernicious, because it's causing us to live our lives wrongly, build our society wrongly, and we should be angry about this book. Maybe not at the author or even the readers, they know not what they do. But certainly anger at the book itself is appropriate. We need to fight against its message until that message has been defeated. What book is he talking about? It's not the, it's not the, although they might lump that in. They're really talking, he's talking about the Bible, isn't he? Humanists believe that there is no authority above human authority. Therefore, morality is determined by man as opposed to an outside source. It's subjective rather than objective. Yeah, it's interesting how many times that they've borrowed from Christ's words, and you're going to even see them borrow more from Christ in just a moment. It's very interesting. I think he's probably mocking in some respects with that reference. The elimination of morality has led our society to a common assent to solipsism. Solipsism is a philosophical school of thought. What solipsism is it's this idea that everyone has their own reality, that their reality is constituted by their own experiences and perceptions. In other words, I determine truth for myself. I determine my own reality. Let me give you an illustration. A 17-year-old researcher was investigating the origins of ethical relativism in lower grades. In his research, he offered a 10-year-old this hypothetical. You find a lot of money in a paper bag on the sidewalk, what do you do? The fifth grader decided that it would be right for him to keep it, but for another person, it might be right to take it to the police, for another to donate it to charity. The fifth grader concluded, in general, there are different rights and wrongs for different people, and who can say more? The interviewing senior suggested maybe God. The fifth grader asserted his agnosticism. He knew that weak and ignorant folks somewhere out in the boondocks might find his enlightened views unbearable, but he was willing to entertain the hypothesis that God exists and acknowledge that, if he does, God could have a different opinion from mine. That's what we're talking about. Determining one's own reality, determining one's own morals. This is solipsism in its most basic form. Truth is defined by the individual based on their experiences and perceptions. The individual is empowered as the arbiter of truth, while God is demoted to an equal or lesser plane. The humanist, however, cannot avoid the consequences of this strain of thought. In his book, The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky warned, I even have a sister who speaks Russian, that's the ironic thing about it. Dostoevsky warned, if you were to destroy a mankind, the belief in immortality, not only love, but every living force maintaining the life of the world would be at once dried up. Moreover, nothing then would be immoral. Everything would be permissible, even cannibalism. And Dostoevsky's right. If you say that there is no immortality, if you say that there is no absolute truth, what is it that keeps man from doing anything? Even cannibalism is possible. And so, appalled by this horrifying reality of a world without God and morality without objectivity, contemporary humanists have fervently sought for healthy, nonviolent ways for groups of people as well as individuals to relate to one another, and their answer is altruism. What is altruism? Altruism is the principle or practice of unselfish concern for or devotion to the welfare of others. And the humanist believes that this is part of the evolutionary process. The humanist says that you can look at an animal demonstrating altruistic tendencies. Animals sometimes an animal will sense that there's a predator nearby, and they will sacrifice themselves to alert the herd so that the herd can get away. They point to this idea of altruism as a part of our DNA, our biology, a result of evolution. One humanist wrote this: "For all the thinking and writing of millennia of philosophers, there is a widely agreed principle which underlies all morality. It was known to the golden, it was known as the golden rule by the ancient Greeks: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or modified into: don't do unto others what you wouldn't want done to you. This principle of reciprocity is at the heart of morality." Now, you may read that and think to yourself, well, that's what Jesus taught, isn't it? Jesus taught the golden rule, and he did. He did teach it. But notice where else it's found. Brahmanism: this is the sum of duty. Do not unto others which would cause pain if done to you. Buddhism: hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful. Confucianism: is there one maxim which ought to be acted upon throughout one's whole life? Surely it is the maxim of loving kindness: do not unto others what you would not have them do unto you. Islam, which seems kind of ironic in this day and age: no one of you is a believer until he desires for his brother that which he desires for himself. Judaism: what is hateful to you, do not to your fellow man. That is the entire law. All the rest is commentary. Taoism: regard your neighbor's gain as your own gain, and your neighbor's loss as your own loss. Jainism: the essence of right conduct is not to injure anyone. What the humanist argues is, because you see this maxim, this principle, in all sorts of religious and non-religious contexts, that this is as absolute a maxim as you can arrive at, that the golden rule should be the thing which guides all human interaction. I'm quickly running out of time. What you're beginning to notice, I think already, I think what Tom has pointed out, is that humanist morality blends in elements of Christianity. Now, you could argue that that last point was blending in elements of Christianity, but I want to remind you, those things appeared in all sorts of different non-religious and religious contexts. But what we see in humanism is this blending in of Christianity. Richard Rorty, in his work Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, preaches a value that he calls solidarity. And his solidarity is this: he calls for human beings to deepen their sympathy or empathy and compassion, and extend their capacities to overlook tribal, cultural, religious, and other differences, to move toward a more and more inclusive sense of we, a value he calls solidarity. He was asked toward the end of his life what he believed was holy, and this was his response. "My sense of the holy is bound up with the hope that someday my remote descendants will live in a global civilization in which love is pretty much the own law." Now, for some of you, that statement sounds hauntingly familiar, doesn't it? We've heard that statement among our brethren in the last 50 years, haven't we? Love is the only law. Some of you have heard that in your own lifetime. I read that quotation and I got chills, because I'm thinking to myself, look at all these various tentacles that are just creeping their way throughout society. It's really amazing. Richard Rorty, who's one of the premier postmodern philosophers of the 20th century, hit on this idea of compassion, this idea of unity, this idea of love. This was his ideal for humanist morality. Now, does that sound familiar to you? I know it sounds familiar to me. Matthew chapter 22, verses 36 through 40. "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Love. Agape. See the correlation? Matthew chapter 25, verses 34 through 36. "Then the king will say to those on his right hand, 'Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me.'" Compassion, human compassion, see the similarities between what they're espousing and what the New Testament is teaching. I heard Michael Moore quote this passage a couple of years ago when he was on a program talking about the necessity for universal health care in the United States. He quoted this verse as evidence for it. Doesn't Jesus say? One more passage, Galatians chapter 3, verses 27 through 28. For as many as of you as were baptized into Christ to put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Unity, the breaking down of barriers, the breaking down of tribal and cultural and racial and gender differences. That's what Jesus Christ brought in to the inheritance that he offers. There is no more Jew or Greek. Can you see that the morality that the humanist is putting forward is a morality taken in part from the very Bible that we're reading? But they're only taking the good parts, aren't they? They're only taking the easy parts. And I'm going to depart for a moment from the slides here because I'm almost out of time and I want to be sure I get to these points. What humanistic morality lacks, apart from an acknowledgement of God, is a moral directive for private life, personal life, or internal life. When we go back to humanism's moral foundation, which is altruism, altruism guides people's interpersonal contact. It guides how people conduct themselves in their relationships. But altruism says nothing about a person's internal purity, about a person's internal motivations. It doesn't talk about their private lives and their personal lives. Some of you are old enough to remember about 12 years ago when the big debacle over Monica Lewinsky broke out with Bill Clinton. Do you all remember that? And do you remember all the people in the media that were trying to draw this distinction between public life and private life? It doesn't matter what he was doing in his private life. That's what humanism teaches. Morality in private life doesn't matter. It's only the public life that matters. Now, is that the morality that Jesus Christ teaches? By no means. That is not the morality that Jesus Christ teaches. The morality or goodness embraced by humanism is not the inward-outward morality that Jesus Christ teaches. I'll just give you one passage. Mark chapter 7, verses 14 through 16. When he had called all the multitude to himself, he said to them, "Hear me, everyone, and understand. There is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him, but the things which come out of him, those are the things that defile a man. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear." Jesus Christ is concerned with internal purity. He's concerned with internal motivations. He's concerned with us conducting ourselves in private like we do in public. He doesn't want a bunch of hypocrites. But that's the morality that humanism espouses. That's the morality they uphold. That's all they care about, is what's in public view, what happens between people. They don't care how bad of a person you are in private. They don't care about your internal motivation. This is not the morality that Jesus Christ taught. One final point, and I'll close with this. Unlike humanists, we as Christians do not enjoy the luxury of choosing which ideals to embrace and choosing which ideals to ignore. Undoubtedly, the Christian faith contains some very difficult teachings to accept. As Jesus' disciples observed in John chapter 6, verse 60. In John 6, 60, Jesus' disciples say, after this very exhaustive teaching on Jesus being the bread of life, how he's just talked about eating his flesh and drinking his blood, they arrive at this point where they say, "This is a hard saying. Who can understand it?" Undoubtedly, there were certain aspects of Jesus' ministry which initially attracted these disciples. Perhaps it was the miraculous signs that he performed. Perhaps it was his visible compassion that he showed toward the multitudes. Perhaps it was this mystery surrounding his identity. And yet, when they were confronted with some of the more difficult aspects of Jesus' teaching, what did they do? They left it. They turned around, they left, and they followed him no more. It was Gilbert K. Chesterton who observed, "Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and not tried." The same Jesus who said, "Neither do I condemn you," also said, "I came not to bring peace, but a sword." Broad is the way to destruction, and many go in thereby. And repent, or you will all likewise perish. Humanist morality says if a given religious precept can help lead to a good life in good society, we may adopt it. But the difficult parts which strain human relationships, which demand an eternal perspective, which will cause certain members of our society to feel a little bit of discomfort, the humanists, they'll ignore those parts of the Bible, since they want to avoid cruelty. Like Thomas Jefferson, the humanist morality cuts and pastes the most appealing New Testament passages while discarding the rest. That's the humanist morality. Oh, they like a few things from the New Testament, but they get to pick and choose. We don't have that luxury, brothers. We have to accept the whole enchilada, as the old cliche goes. Anything else as we close this evening? I know this hasn't been the easiest presentation to listen to for a variety of reasons. I know we've covered a lot of territory. I hope you found it helpful. And if you've got more questions or comments, I'll entertain those in our break, and I'll give you 15 minutes off. Actually, 17 minutes. So give you a couple extra minutes. Thank you all.